This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is from the Transmission of Light, Case 35, Qingyuan. Qingyuan went to study with Zen Master Huainong and asked, "What work is to be done so as to not fall into stages?" Huainong said, "What have you done?" Qingyuan said, "I do not even practice the holy truths." Huainong said, "What stage do you fall into?" Qingyuan said, "If I don't even practice the holy truths, what stages are there?" Huainong recognized his great capacity. The verse, "Coming and going on the bird's path, there are no tracks. How can you look for stages on the mystic road?" So this last few days, we've been studying the Buddha's teaching on the seven factors of enlightenment, a teaching that began with the Buddha and that he held up as being a really important and essential teaching in terms of speaking about the factors, beginning with mindfulness, that are cultivated, that naturally reside within us, but that are cultivated and strengthened and that lead each into the next factor, and are those factors that are important for us on this path of awakening. And I was thinking in terms of that, in terms of the theme of our Ango, the Eightfold Path, within our own training of the Eight Gates and this very traditional, old traditional sort of depiction of the path that's portrayed in the Ten Oxherding pictures and verses downstairs on the dining room wall. And in our own training that we have, many of you are come here on Sundays or here for the retreat and maybe here for the first time or come here periodically. We have people who are training students, people who have done Jikai, taken the precepts, senior students. Within the monastic path, we have stages of discernment, postulancy, novitiate, full ordination. The Buddha spoke in great detail about stages of the path, stages of meditation and its development. Within the Mahayana, there are the different stages of the Bodhisattva path. And so throughout the teachings and brought out in how we actually practice and train together, this question of stages, levels, becomes very important. And it's very important because these are ways that we think. Right? I mean, there's a reason why the Buddha presented the teachings in this way. There are reasons why the practice is presented in this way. The training is set up in this way. The purpose is for awakening. The purpose is to be skillful means, upaya. Of course, these very same things exist everywhere. In our world, we create levels and stages and ranks within roles, within groups, within our personality. We have the high part of our person, and we have the low part of our person. Those qualities that are superior and those qualities that are inferior. We can, you know, typically we'll look at our own development in terms of development, of progress, and there is a sense of progress. Having a path itself suggests that we're moving, that we start here and we move forward. It's even within the Doshinji's code that if a student is not progressing within the path, that should be of concern. What does that mean, to progress? How is that discerned? Why is that important? What does it mean when there isn't progress? And so it's not a, you know, as I said, I think yesterday, there's nothing about it that's theoretical. It's not abstract. We're not just in some sort of philosophical, you know, game. This is really about life and death. It's really about the great matter is the matter we're in the midst of every moment. The whole point is to bring all our attention and bring forth all that we possess as human beings and our capacity, our great capacity to do good forward. When I was thinking about this and preparing this talk earlier in the week, I was thinking of it in terms of training and levels of you know, stages and so on. But in just reading the news over the last couple of days, I was thinking also into the stages of delusion, the stages of suffering, the stages of cruelty, the levels and sophistication, different levels of sophistication of cruelty and inhumanity. I was just reading this really, kind of amazing article and research that's been done. You know, I was thinking journalists should get the Nobel Prize for Peace, the truth tellers. And they did this very extensive research to prove that Russians are bombing Syrian hospitals. Hospitals. What work is to be done is so as not to fall into stages, into our stages of madness, and into our stages of awakening. From the beginning, Buddha nature is present, complete, it's manifesting. And yet, because of how we're put together as human beings, our instrument, our consciousness, our mind, our bodies, our senses, our thoughts, our memories, everything, the complexity of that, we get so easily turned away from what is true. We get so easily turned away from what is even sensible, from an ordinary, reasonable perspective, and something else becomes sensible and reasonable. You know, as we were talking yesterday, and I said that I feel like it's really important, particularly in our time and our culture, you know, to think of dukkha, the first noble truth, that all conditioned things are dukkha, which is translated as suffering, as disappointment, and dissatisfaction, to think of dukkha as a condition that exists as all conditioned things do. It's conditioned, being conditioned means that it is dependent upon other factors in order to come into being. Dukkha doesn't just exist. It isn't just is. It's dependent on certain factors to come together in order for dukkha to come into being, suffering, disappointment, dissatisfaction. And that nobody has to teach us how to grasp and cling. Right? That capacity is already within us. Of course, our circumstances, our relationships, our culture and society can exacerbate, compound our attachments and clinging, can glorify them, enshrine them. We can set things up so that the more attachments you have, the more success you have. Certain attachments. You have to get the right ones to be successful. But it's in us. And then I said, I think that, you know, thinking about it that way can help to sort of de-demonize that aspect of our nature. It's in everyone. It's universal. And if we don't do anything, it just keeps happening. Just like any system that's in place and becomes habitual and is set up to continue perpetuating itself. And that's what practice is to disrupt that system. But in doing that we don't go to war, another war, against ourselves, seeing that as another enemy. And in the same way that in training, when we get hung up on things, we get hung up within our delusion, our sort of negativities, then we get hung up in our positivities, right? I mean, that's what the factors are speaking about, that through the course of practice, good things happen. That mindfulness is a pleasant experience, is a positive experience. And that it gives rise to energy, the vitality, the vibrancy, the vigorousness of life. That feels good. And rapture. We talked about what does that mean? And calm. These are experiences that we have within ourselves that are very natural and that we can very easily grasp at because they feel good. And so what Ching-Wan is asking is a very, very important question. In a sense, it's how do we actually continue to move along the path of liberation? Ching-Wan was a student of Huineng, as it makes clear in the koan, and a very important student and went on to be his own teacher. And so this is early, very early in the Zen tradition, late 7th, early 8th century. And when he first came, this is a story about when he first came to Huineng to study with him. And it says that Huineng recognized his profound capacity. It's not saying he recognized his enlightenment, but he recognized his profound capacity. And Huineng went on to Ching-Wan went on to teach Shidao, who was the author of the Identity of Relative Absolute that we chanted this morning. So that's also a poem that figures very, very early in our own tradition. And so this question, what work is to be done to us not to fall into stages? One day, Ching-Wan said to his Sangha, in the past, the robe and teaching, so up to the point of Huineng, it said that when Bodhidharma transmitted the teaching to Huika, that he gave him his kesa, his robe, and his oryokibo, as a symbol of the transmission, but also as a proof, like a certificate showing, validating that he had been empowered to teach, and that had continued. So Huineng had also received Bodhidharma's robe and bowl. And so here, Huineng says to his disciple, in the past, the robe and teaching have been passed down together, each generation of teacher and student passing them on in turn. He said, the robe has been the evidence of the transmission. The authentic teaching is passed from mind to mind. Now I have suitable heirs. Why worry about not having evidence of the transmission? Since I have received the robe, I've encountered innumerable difficulties. Moreover, in future times, the competition for the preeminence between different schools of Zen will be even greater. The robe should remain at this monastery. You must establish a separate, your own Sangha, and expound the teaching. Don't allow my Dharma to be cut off. And so what he's saying is that robe and bowl, those objects, had become the source of suffering, competition, and so the self comes along with us as we come into practice. And even as we proceed along the path of awakening, as the Buddha said, it is the deepest, strongest, most resilient, in a certain sense, aspect of our clinging. That sense of I that keeps arising. That sense of mine that keeps arising. And so which means it needs to continue to be a very clear awareness and focus of our practice and our letting go and our realization. And when that's not happening, problems occur. Just as they do everywhere, they occur within monasteries, within communities, between practitioners. We spoke yesterday about the Buddhist teaching on the eight worldly concerns, which are basically the sort of the fundamental dualities that bind us: gain and loss, praise and blame, pain and suffering, pain and pleasure, and fame and disrepute. Those things that we strive towards and we try and avoid. We strive towards gain, we try and avoid loss. We we seek praise, we try to avoid being blamed. And as I said, our success in society is often measured at how well we can profit from those worldly concerns and sort of ignore or deny or sort of outsource the downside, right? The cost of it. How do I not fall into stages? How do I not be entangled by, deceived by? How do I not create suffering within stages? And so, of course, in order to practice something, in order to not fall, we have to study falling, which means we have to fall and study while falling. We have to study stages. In all, because stages is just a word. What does it mean? So we have to study all the ways in which we fall into something that is set apart from something else, something that is lower or higher, something that is better or worse. And as we do that, we can see ourselves falling, or we can not see ourselves falling. We can begin to see the various ways in which we fall and not know why. Not know why that's happening. We can begin to understand how we fall, the construction of that, the conditions that are necessary for that, but be unable to change our course. We can become more adept at changing our course and not falling, but still fall. And then we can realize that falling itself is an illusion. That falling is just a frame of reference. Something is happening, and we call it falling. And because we call it that, it becomes, in our mind, something. Something more, something other, something different. And the Dharma teaching is really presenting us with perfection. The perfection of your body and mind, the perfection of your nature, the perfection of each and every moment, each and every thing. And that is not the perfection of perfectionism. We have to get very, very clear on that. And when we're not, we're falling. It's not the perfection of striving, of competing, of accomplishing. It's not the perfection of never falling. It is the great way is perfect like vast space, no excess, no lack. It's Milarepa's, my mind is as vast as the sky and my attention is as fine as a grain of flour. Dogen says, it is just, exactly. You are already a person of suchness. Why worry? But if these teachings point to what is true, the teachings, all the teachings point to this truth, that we are this perfect, then why is the path so long? Why is it so difficult? Why do we fall into stages? We can say attachments, we can say the self, we can say karmic obstructions. But those are words. What is the truth of it? There's an early, in the early canon, in the early teachings of the Buddha, there are a series of encounters between Mara and different disciples, female disciples of the Buddha. And in each of them, the Mara seeks out one of the nuns, ordained monastics of the Buddha, and tries basically, who's practicing. He always comes to them when they're practicing, which is all the time. And he tries to get them to fall. That's all he's interested in. And Mara, incidentally, is you and me. And so this nun is Sisupakala. And Mara comes to her and says, whose creed do you approve of? Whose doctrine? Whose set of beliefs do you follow? And she says, I don't approve of anyone's creed, friend. And Mara says, under whom have you shaved your head? You do appear to be an ascetic, yet you don't approve of any creed. So then why do you wander around this way? And Sisupakala said, outside here, the followers of creeds place their confidence in views. I don't approve of those teachings. They are not skilled in the Dharma. They are not skilled in the nature of reality. But there is one born in the Shakyam clan, the enlightened one without an equal, conqueror of all, Mara's subduer, who everywhere is undefeated, everywhere freed and unattached, the one with vision, who sees through all things. Attained to the end of all karma, liberated in the extinction of all acquisitions, that blessed one is my teacher. His is the teaching I approve. But Mara said, whose creed do you follow? And here she says, I don't follow any creed, and the Buddha's teaching is what I follow, what I approve. And so what she's saying is, she's making clear that the Buddha's teaching is not a creed. It's not a set of beliefs. It's not a doctrine. The words appear on pages. They're collected into sutras. But those are, in a sense, shadows of the Buddha's teaching. What is the Buddha's teaching? Kazan says, Kazan was a compiler and the commentator of this collection. He said, even if contrivance ends, and think of contrivance as just creating something, building something in our mind. Even if contrivance ends, there is still some preservation of the self. If you are like this, then you'll make the mistake of falling into the deep pit of liberation. So this state has always been called religious attachment. And so within every stage of practice, there are certain pitfalls, certain traps that we have to be careful about. That's really what those 10 oxherding pictures are presenting, are alerting us to. And that they're pretty universal. And this pit of liberation he speaks of is that having come to some realization that things have no abiding self, that things are empty, that we attach to that and the view that things are utterly non-existent, that they have no existence at all. And so Qinghuan says, what work is to be done so as not to fall into stages? And Huanong says, what are you doing? What have you done? And Qinghuan says, I do not even practice the holy truths. He's really saying, I do not even practice. Has he fallen into a pit? It's interesting, there's another dialogue with Dongshan and his teacher, where Dongshan comes to Yunyan and says, I have some habits that are not yet exhausted. Right? Him too. And Yunyan says, what have you been doing? Dongshan said, I have not concerned myself with the Four Noble Truths. I do not even practice the Four Noble Truths. Yunyan said, are you joyful yet? And those of you who are here for the retreat, think of that. Are you joyful yet? He's asking a real question. Because joyfulness is an aspect of the path. It is a factor for enlightenment. It is an indication of what a student is not only practicing, but what they're experiencing. It is an indication of their path, their journey. And so it's not just a trivial question. It's a very informed question, you might say. from within the understanding of Buddhism. Are you joyful yet? And Dongshan says, it would be untrue to say that I am not joyful. It is as though I've grasped a bright pearl in a pile of shit. So what is this? I do not concern myself with the Four Noble Truths. I do not even practice. And this comes up again and again in the Prajnaparamita Sutra of 8,000 lines. The Buddha said, do not take a stand in form, in feeling, in perception, in your impulses, in consciousness, in the skandhas. Do not take a stand in your eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind. Do not take a stand in practice, in holding on, in letting go, in delusion, in enlightenment. Remember in the Vimalakirti Sutra, those of you who study it, when all the disciples finally go to Vimalakirti, the enlightened lay disciple of the Buddha, to pay him a sick call, and Shariputra, I don't remember who the disciple is, but one of the Buddha's disciples, because there are 10,000 people in this little tiny hut coming to visit Vimalakirti, and let's say Shariputra is looking around and thinking, where are they all going to sit? Very ordinary thought. And Vimalakirti sees his thought and says, Shariputra, did you come here for the sake of a chair? Is that why you're here? And then he goes through this very, very relentless questioning. Did you come here for this? Did you come here for that? Did you come here for the Dharma? Did you come here for the Sangha? Did you come here for the Buddha? Because if you came for any of those things, then you're off track. You're falling into stages. And at the end he says, if you came to not stand in any place, then you have come. If we don't understand what these teachings say, then we can understand this. Well, here's this celebrated master. I do not even practice the Four Noble Truths, so then why should I? He doesn't practice, why should I practice? That should not satisfy us, right? We should know there is something else going on here, right? Because that just simply doesn't make sense. Here is he's standing in his monk's robes, talking to his teacher, asking to enter into training in a monastery, to study the Buddha Dharma, to realize these very teachings that I do not even practice. What does this mean? So we can misunderstand that to think it's not important. These stages, these levels, these ways of training, these different ways that we put together the path. I remember when I was thinking about this, I was remembering a conversation. I got a call years ago from a prison chaplain that I didn't know. He called from some prison where they had a Buddhist group developing there. And the group was asking for an altar like this. Probably much more humble than that, but for an altar so that they could have it when they practice. And so this chaplain, who was a Catholic priest, called me and said, is that necessary in Buddhism? Do you have to have an altar? Earlier, if I'd gotten that call earlier, I would have said no, because it's not necessary. But I had learned by being involved in prison work and dealing with chaplains and administrators that that's not necessarily skillful. And so I said, because if I say no, then that's an easy answer for them to just use against the inmates and say, I called somebody, the abbot, and he said, you don't need an altar, so you don't get an altar. And so I said to the priest, I said, you're a Catholic priest, right? He said, yes. I said, do you have a chapel where you can do services and do mass? He said, of course. I said, do you have an altar? And he was quiet. And I said, that's how it's necessary. Huenong said, what stage do you fall into? Kezon says, without relying on seeing and hearing, not being involved in knowing objects, try to see what is underneath. And really, that isn't that what our practice is about? Trying to see what is underneath. It's easy to just see the surface. Everybody sees the surface. That doesn't mean we all see the same thing. But we see things just as they appear to us. But what does it mean to look underneath? What does it mean to look underneath a thought, an intention, a situation, a catastrophe, a mind? And so beginning with the Buddha, with the very beginning of his teaching, his first teaching was in a sense the establishing or the the non-establishing of stages, the Four Noble Truths. First, we have to understand that life is dukkha. And then we have to practice and relinquish our attachments. And then we need to realize nirvana, cessation, peace. And then we practice the Four Noble Truths, or the Eightfold Path. But Kezon says, in reality, even if you try to set up stages, fundamentally, there are no boundaries. Where can you put a ladder? Right? So it's a good image, you know. So you set up a ladder where we're going to climb, rung by rung, step by step, and we're going to ascend. We're going to climb to this higher view. And he's saying, where are you going to put that ladder? What are you going to lean it against? And then he says, those who interpret this point literally have since ancient times fallen into view that all things are empty and have formed the understanding that therefore all things don't exist. Chingwan said he didn't even practice the holy truths. How could he linger in the emptiness of things? And there he's pointing right to the heart of the matter. How could we linger? And so in a sense, you could say that our practice is a practice of ceaselessly not lingering. No loitering. To exhaust our acquisitions, our appropriations. You know, appropriation is a good word. You know, to think of how we take something and we appropriate it, we make it ours. And so, in truth, you know, in the beginning, all of the forms and structures, the teachings, are upaya. And if they speak to us, then that's because they are upaya for us. They're helpful. They resonate. They draw us in. They help us establish faith. They guide us. All of what we call training is that. And because of that, we can, in a sense, fall in love. Not with everything, usually, but enough. And we fall in love because it's helping to bring us to life. It's starting to respond to what needs to be responded to. It's some sanity. And we see our lives changing. And within that, as so often happens with love, we can become attached. We do become attached. I mean, it's not really a question as to whether that's going to happen. Let's just, like, get that established. How would it not? How would we just stop the moment we walk in the door? Stop doing something we've been doing all our whole lives. That's just not going to happen, right? And so we continue to do it, but we're doing it now within a mind that is more awake, within understanding that is developing, surrounded by good friends who have similar aspirations, so that we can ultimately see that the robes and the incense and the altars and the Buddha and the prostrations and the teachings and the buildings and the stages and that very idea of progress are upaya and are also empty. They are nothing to stand in. They have no inherent value, but they do have value. They just don't have inherent value. And that is the whole thing. If we can understand that and merge that, see that as unified and live that, then there's no more need to acquire and appropriate. Where would we put that ladder? Daroshi was speaking in the film we watched yesterday, which was a film that he made in 1990, which was our 10th year. So it was a celebration of having made it to 10 years, having paid off the mortgage, him having received full transmission and being a full teacher in his own right, and of having been recognized as the abbot in a big ceremony we call Shinsan Chiki, which that pillar out front was erected as that. If you look at the back of it, the other three sides, which were calligraphied, have all faded out in the sunlight. But the back side, because it's facing north, you can still make out. And so you can see, because it has the date of the Shinsan Chiki. But in the film, he was talking about, because this was all very fresh in him, and I was saying to somebody at breakfast that he was really, because so much of those early years was, you know, will we make it? And he talked about a particular moment where it seemed pretty clear we weren't going to make it. I wasn't here yet. Whew! There were still plenty of those questions when I got here, but it was not quite so stark. And but then somebody showed up, and they continued. And but he was, so that sort of survival mentality had ebbed a little bit, and he was clearly thinking forward. None of us were. We were just thinking, you know, just show up, practice, and you'll be here forever. He knew he was not going to be here forever. And he was already planning, already thinking deeply about the day, which could happen any day, when he would not be here. And he was thinking of us. He was thinking of today. He was thinking of today 40 years later from now, 100 years later. And he was talking about how important it was, he felt, to establish, that was his job, was to establish what this was. What is this mountain? What is this training? How are we going to do this? How are we going to draw from our tradition, enact, bring forth, practice our tradition, Buddha Dharma, and within the Zen tradition? How was he going to bring forth his training? And how was he going to also do that in a way that was responsive to both his vision, his juice, and also us? And that time in this place, in such a way that it was grounded in these ancient wisdoms and also was alive and responsive to today. And he said, so that's what he wanted to do, so that there was enough structure so that as we carried on after him, that was developed. The roots were there. But there was enough flexibility that we could adapt and change as needed. And he said, maybe the eight gates at some point won't be what we do here. Maybe that will be seen to be no longer the best way to train. You know. And so he really understood that. You know, he was fierce, and he was very demanding about how things wanted to be done. And part of that, I think, because he wanted, that was his sort of devotion to establishing the foundation. Because if it wasn't clear, if it wasn't really in us, then it wasn't established. And it wasn't clear, you know, because we were all new. We were young, you know. And so that was really his role. And so that, you know, that other aspect that he understood so well was about the expansiveness, the ability to change. Because the body and mind is so vast and wide, because this Dharma is true all the way through. And why can I say that? Because it's not a ladder. Because it's not anything you can lean on. Anything that you can lean on may be based in truth and have upaya, but because you can lean on it, it also includes everything else. Because nothing appears alone. Everything appears altogether. And so just as the whole purpose of training is to help us liberate ourselves, if we lean on it in ways that are not helpful, then it's not going to help us do that, and it actually can hurt us. We can hurt ourselves. That's why we train, to try and ensure that we are all together and individually practicing and training in a way that is actually liberating. So that we can ultimately realize there isn't a single dharma to rely upon, and that is our liberation. All form dharmas are forms of emptiness. So that we can find our freedom within these 10,000 things. So if you look at the Oxfordian pictures, the student begins struggling, lost, confused, exhausted. And at the end, that last Oxfordian picture, the mature practitioner is barefoot, mingling with people of the world. Their clothes are ragged, they're covered in dust, and they are blissful. Are you joyful? He's not asking about, did somebody just tell you a nice joke? Did you just have a nice meal and are feeling good about it? Those are nice things. He's asking a much deeper question. He's asking a question that is underneath, a joy that is underneath. We can't discover rising without falling. We can't move forward without understanding falling back, regressing. We can't learn how to stay on the path without getting lost. Really. Getting lost is a necessary part. It doesn't mean you should go out and try to get lost. You don't have to go try. It's happening. We can't live without dying. We can't die well without living. And these are not mistakes. They're not crimes. They're not signs of our incompetence. They're conditions. How do we use them? When we pit our practice against the world, when we pit ourselves against ourselves, when we hold enlightenment in competition with delusion, our progress opposed to our regressing, our falling, our sincerity, when our sincerity becomes righteousness, our dedication, our commitment becomes another acquisition. We're climbing a ladder that in fact stands on empty ground. We think it's reliable. We think it's trustworthy. We think it's going to hold together. And then what happens? Falls apart. Those factors that we've been studying over the last few days, they come apart. They are made to come apart. They are supposed to come apart. That's their nature. Just like you're going to come apart. I'm coming. We are coming apart all the time, every moment. That's our nature. And that's the invitation and the imperative of this Dharma. That was the Buddha's enlightenment. Having looked deeply underneath so that we can live all throughout. And so to train, it's important for us to ourselves and together to make it real training, that when we practice the Dharma, that it's true Dharma. In the poem, coming and going on the bird's path, there are no tracks. How can you look for stages on the mystic path? And so we can each follow the examples of birds and ducks, the great blue heron, which is our ally, that leaves no trace in the air, in the water, and they go without worry, and they find their way. May we do so and realize our Buddha nature. And study the falling all around us. You know, I talked yesterday about the study of the Dharma and how really important I feel like it is to study karma and all of these teachings within the world that we see around us. You know, I was talking a little bit about Trump, and I thought, you know, our president is really an amazing example of these eight worldly concerns. An amazing example, because it's also on display. You know, I said, usually we try and be more sophisticated, you know, at our devilry, you know, in our hatred, in our prejudices, in our greed, in our delusion. You know, we try and hide it a little, right? Which I take as a sign of our morality. We realize there's something not quite right here, so we try and tuck it in a bit. But here we have this vivid display that I don't think there is the capacity to hide it in. There's not even that level of understanding or examination or development, which is what makes him so dangerous. And delusion so dangerous. And also a study for us, you know, because he is not us. We are not him. And so, as I said yesterday, at this time and place, what are we to be learning? You know, as practitioners, we should always be learning when we fall. You know, we should try and study and practice as we're falling. What an incredible opportunity, as we're rising from the ground, to study and practice. How do you rise from the ground? But even if we miss that opportunity, because it goes by too quickly, we got sucked in too deeply, there's the next moment. Reflect. Stop. Think. Examine. Turn to the teachings. And to do that wherever we go. It helps. I really think it helps to realize the world is not actually insane. We act insanely, but the world itself is not insane. It's nothing is random, nor is it planned. As the Bodhidharma said, when stuff happens, he didn't say it quite like that, he said, when stuff happens, don't be surprised. When we really understand deeply and more delusion, it breaks our heart, it breaks my heart, it's disturbing. But more and more, it doesn't surprise. Right? And in that are the conditions, both for the creation of that and for their turning, for their rising up off the ground. And so, following the way of birds and ducks, mountains and rivers, and wise ones and sages.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JizoProject.